This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
The Binge. As Amerithrax picked up steam, the FBI turned to its profilers to come up with a potential portrait of the anthrax mailer. They said he was likely an American man, a loner who kept to himself and didn't have much social grace, someone who could hold a grudge, and most importantly, a highly educated scientist with the specialized skills to refine anthrax. One of the squad's first recruits was Ken Cole, a prosecutor with the Department of Justice. All major cases have a lawyer like Ken on board to help them build a case once they have someone to prosecute. It's Ken's job to make sure the squad's investigative methods are above board and that the evidence they collect is admissible in court. He knew right away this would be an uphill battle.
First of all, it's a letter attack, right? So there's a certain anonymity to mailing letters. But we also didn't know where the letters were mailed from. It took almost 20 years to solve the Unabomber case, right? And that guy had repeatedly sent bombs around the United States, even published a manifesto.
They didn't have a manifesto. All they had so far were four letters and a few teaspoons of anthrax. In order to find the person who sent the letters, first the squad needed to figure out which mailbox or mailboxes the letters had been sent from. The letters were all postmarked in Trenton, New Jersey. That narrowed their search to the 3,000 mailboxes that route through Trenton.
Let's pull all these mailboxes in, find which one is most heavily contaminated with anthrax, you know, five, six at a time, swab them, clean them, sanitize them, and put them back.
Then they scrutinized the letters, which were actually photocopies, not originals. Investigators figured if they could identify a copier with the same smudges and scratches as the ones in the letter, they might have a lead. The team swabbed mailboxes and inspected Xerox machines across New Jersey for months, without any real progress. It was painstaking work, and they were getting nowhere. It was becoming clear to the FBI that if they wanted to catch a break, they'd have to go public.
This is America's investigation. We believe there's someone out in the country somewhere that may have information, that may have mentored, may be aware of what this person is doing, may have a little piece of information that would help complete the puzzle for us. We are asking for the public's help. And if someone feels they have some information, no matter how small or how remote they think it may be, we are very interested in that. This is a cold-blooded murderer.
One scientist took on the challenge herself. She developed her own profile of the killer and her own theory of the attacks.
I think that there's no question that the anthrax attacks originated in some way from a U.S. government laboratory.
And she'd helped turn Amerithrax into one of the most embarrassing fiascos in the Bureau's history. From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up, the Anthrax Threat. Episode 4, The Scapegoat.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise. The island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Barbara Hatch Rosenberg is a bioterrorism expert. She joins us now live on the telephone from Purchase, New York. Give us the type of person. Obviously, you don't know, Barbara, specifically who may have done this, but the universe of suspects, I take it, is rather small.
Certainly is. It's got to be someone who has had hands-on experience handling anthrax and handling probably weaponized anthrax.
Barbara Hatch Rosenberg was part of an association of scientists dedicated to advocacy against bioweapons. During the Cold War, the U.S. had signed a treaty with 182 other countries. It agreed to shut down all bioweapons research for offensive purposes. But Rosenberg and her colleagues were skeptical that the government had kept its word. She was in her 70s with black-rimmed glasses and short-cropped hair when she became one of the media's go-to guests for her theories on the anthrax mailer. Here she is talking to Wolf Blitzer on CNN.
And so we're talking about what? Hundreds, dozens, thousands? How many people
would
fit this profile?
We're talking about under 50 people. And I think once you start weeding them out, it's got to be down to under 10.
In a series of papers and speeches after the attacks, Rosenberg laid out her theory. She believed the anthrax mailer was not only an American scientist, but someone who worked for the U.S. government. She wrote, "He is cocksure that he can get away with it. Does he know something that he believes to be sufficiently damaging to the United States to make him untouchable by the FBI?" The media found Rosenberg's speculation tantalizing, especially since it seemed like she had a specific person in mind. Someone the FBI was keeping an eye on, but hadn't fully investigated. The New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof exchanged emails with Rosenberg and brought her theories to a national audience. Kristof wrote, "I think I know who sent the anthrax last fall," in a column titled "Profile of Killer." It was the first of six columns he would write on the subject. The FBI hadn't publicly named any suspects of its own, and Kristof would give his suspect the mysterious name Mr. Z, supposedly to respect the man's privacy. He claimed that Mr. Z had multiple passports and hidden identities, that Mr. Z was responsible for a 1997 anthrax hoax in D.C., and that he'd been in Zimbabwe in 1980, when an anthrax outbreak killed hundreds of people. Kristof painted a scary portrait, an American scientist with the access and skills to carry out the attacks. In his weekly columns, he laid into the FBI for its, quote, ineptitude.
I wanted to prod the FBI because I thought there was an awful lot that they weren't doing. I wanted to light a fire under them.
Rosenberg even suggested that the U.S. government itself could be complicit.
Barbara Hatch Rosenberg believes the government has known for quite some time that the anthrax attack is, in her words, an inside job, but is reluctant to admit it because of the embarrassment.
Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, the two senators who'd been sent anthrax letters, were also frustrated with the slow progress of the investigation. Leahy's office found Rosenberg's theories credible enough to arrange a meeting for her with the FBI.
I don't think they really were happy to be there, and they were very skeptical of her information.
Laura Petru, one of Daschle's senior staffers, was at the meeting.
My memory of her actually is that she was pretty nervous and cautious, and you know, she didn't want to name names, and she had lots of caveats. But she was anxious to be sure that she was listened to. I remember being initially skeptical about her claims, but then she seemed like she had facts to back up a lot of her claims. And they didn't really want to listen to her at first. Yeah, I think our position and the Leahy staff position was, you know, the FBI ought to at least listen to her because who knows if some of this might be relevant.
Laura insists that Rosenberg never actually gave the name of a suspect during the meeting. But she thinks there was a wink-wink, nod-nod quality to the conversation. In Laura's mind, it was pretty clear to investigators who Rosenberg was talking about.
They must have listened to her at some point because they got completely focused on Hatfill.
Dr. Stephen J. Hatfill was a 48-year-old American scientist who'd worked in the biowarfare world. He was built like a linebacker with a headstrong personality that had made him stand out in the nerdy microbiology world. Not always in a good way.
Information was coming to us from different sources saying he has the skills and ability to be able to do this.
Tom Delaferra was a senior investigator with the United States Postal Inspection Service.
We're the security service for the Postal Service, right? So we're responsible for physical security and personnel security. And then we investigate the crimes of mail theft, mail fraud, assaults against postal employees, things like that.
Tom was brought onto the team to help the FBI understand how the mail system works and became an integral part of the squad investigation. Delaferra says it wasn't just that one meeting with Rosenberg that turned the FBI's focus to Hatfill.
That led us to, hey, we need to go talk to him. you know, figure out what's going on there. He lives near USAMRIID. He used to work there. It becomes very difficult to eliminate somebody when they have theoretical access to the facility.
There were plenty of reasons for investigators to look into Stephen Hatfill. First off, Hatfill had worked at USAMRIID, one of the U.S. military labs where the Ames strain was abundant and security had been lax. Then there was the fact that just days before the letters were postmarked, Hatfill had gotten a prescription for Cipro, the same antibiotic used to fight off anthrax infections. He'd falsified parts of his resume, and his security clearance had been revoked after he failed a polygraph test unrelated to the anthrax mailings. And there's more. A lot more. Hatfill had commissioned a study from a friend named William C. Patrick III. Patrick was a renowned scientist who'd worked in America's offensive biowarfare programs back in the 1950s. The study was on the viability of sending anthrax spores through mail. And then there was the novel. Hatfill had written a nearly 200-page unfinished novel about a Palestinian terrorist hired by Iraq to carry out a biological attack on Washington. One passage read, "For all its wealth and power, the United States was actually an incredibly easy target for biological terrorism." None of this amounted to any actual proof, but it was all pretty juicy stuff and fit neatly with the FBI's profile of the anthrax mailer. The Amerithrax squad spent months digging into Hatfill's background, interviewing people close to him and Hatfill himself. But they still didn't find any hard evidence tying him to the anthrax letters.
How long may I anticipate that this is going to last? I'm not suggesting it's a root canal. I'm just trying to get some sense.
Victor Glassberg is a civil rights lawyer in Alexandria, Virginia. Behind his desk, there are photos of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr.
Can you tell me, what does civil rights work entail as a lawyer?
Civil rights work, by and large, entails representing individuals whose rights have been violated by the government.
Hatfill hadn't been charged with a crime, but when he started to realize just how much the FBI was focusing on him, he called Vic. We tried to speak with Hatfill ourselves, but he didn't respond to our requests.
What were your first impressions of him?
I thought he was a very intelligent and articulate guy. And I thought that he was telling me the truth, because if he wasn't, he was crazy. I mean, he was facing a federal death penalty.
Why would he have been crazy if he wasn't telling you the truth?
I mean, the bad guys always say they didn't do it, right? And then they get a criminal defense lawyer. I don't practice criminal defense. I'm a civil lawyer.
That was a crucial distinction for Vic. Hatfill wasn't looking for a lawyer to fight looming criminal charges. He hired Vic to defend his civil rights as an American citizen. He wanted Vic to help him protect his name and reputation, which he felt were being dragged through the mud by the FBI and the media. So Vic took the job, and he did everything he could to show the government that Hatfill had nothing to hide.
I wrote to Ken Cole, who was the U.S. attorney handling the case. I wrote to Bob Mueller, the director of the FBI. I wrote to the editorial page editor of the Times. I wrote to Nick Kristof, too. I wrote to every federal official whom I could identify as having any kind of material role in this investigation, to extend an ongoing offer of cooperation, ask questions. We'll give you a handwriting sample, fine. Blood sample, fine. Want to come over and speak to the client, fine. And the next thing I know, I get a call from Steve saying the FBI's raiding his house.
The FBI today searched the apartment of a bioweapons expert who lives next to the Army laboratory that did extensive work with the anthrax virus. In fact, the man whose apartment was searched today, with his consent, worked there for 2 years.
The media had been tipped off to the raid and swarmed Hatfill's apartment building in Frederick, Maryland as it unfolded. For months, the public had been waiting for some sign of progress on the anthrax investigation. Now, the media had given them a name.
How very interesting. There were so many reporters, so many trucks with, you know, those elevated doohickeys to broadcast everything. My goodness, those reporters are really on the job, aren't they? So we know what happened.
But if Vic saw the media coverage as the FBI trying to show the public that they were making progress, Tom and the Amerithrax squad saw the attention differently.
Were you pissed?
Yeah, we weren't happy. it's just another hindrance, right? You know, great pains were made to try to keep it quiet, but somehow the media has good sources and they were there too.
Hatfill had been super cooperative with the FBI so far, but after the media blitz around the search, he and Vic started to feel that their good faith was getting them nowhere. And while the world was getting the message that Hatfill was the FBI's guy, the Bureau refused to officially say he was a suspect.
The FBI would not comment. When asked, Director Robert Mueller had only this to say.
As I said, I can't get onto the what is being undertaken in the course of the investigation, but I do believe we're making progress.
A lifelong prosecutor like Mueller wasn't about to get tripped up into saying something that could jeopardize the case. Even your greenest rookie FBI agent knows better than that. No, to make a screw up that royal, it would take this guy.
Like she's never soared before.
Mr. John David Ashcroft, the 79th U.S. Attorney General, avid singer of patriotic ballads, self-anointer with Crisco oil before his swearing-ins. Google it. And Bob Mueller's boss. Ashcroft once spent $8,000 of taxpayer money to buy drapes to cover a statue with an exposed breast so he wouldn't have to be photographed with nudity in the background. So clearly, he was uniquely qualified to handle delicate PR matters. Ken Cole remembers preparing Ashcroft for any potential media questions about Hatfill.
I wanted to make sure that the attorney general understood we're not saying he's the guy who mailed the letters. He is a person of interest. And I discussed other persons of interest with the attorney general.
Ken was trying to signal to Ashcroft that they needed to tread carefully. They couldn't suggest in any official way that the investigation was centered on Hatfill, or anyone for that matter. The simple fact was that Hatfill hadn't been charged with a crime, and revealing sensitive information could compromise the investigation.
He was going up to New Jersey, so Ashcroft got off the plane, was being badgered by reporters. Stephen Hatfill, this anthrax mailer, and Ashcroft replied,
Mr. Hatfill is a person of interest to the Department of Justice, and for me to comment further would be inappropriate.
And that was what the national media needed. A DOJ official had fingered Stephen Hatfill.
What does it mean to call somebody a person of interest? What does that mean legally?
It means nothing. It's not a term of art that has any significance in the law. A person of interest, everybody's a person of interest, Randy. You're a person of interest. I believe that the use by Ashcroft of the term person of interest to describe Steve epitomized everything that was wrong with this case. They never said he was a suspect because they never had any basis to say he was a suspect. He was on the receiving end of a national hate campaign. And that's when it became clear to me that we had to go aggressively on the offensive.
Steve?
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Ashcroft has repeatedly testified to his strong Christian values. And I highly respect him for this. In practice, however, by openly, repeatedly, and naming me as a person of interest, Mr. Ashcroft has not only violated Justice Department regulations and guidelines, but in my view, he has broken the Ninth Commandment. Thou shalt not bear false witness. I want to look my fellow Americans directly in the eye and declare to them, I am not the anthrax killer. I know nothing about the anthrax attacks. I had absolutely nothing to do with this terrible crime. This assassination of my character appears to be part of a government effort to show the American people that it is proceeding vigorously and successfully with the anthrax investigation. I am openly followed by the FBI agents and in cars and on foot 24 hours a day. Going down to the store for a pack of gum yields a parade of FBI cars sometimes following me closely as 2 to 4 feet from my rear bumper.
Hatfill steps up to a microphone in front of Vic's office. It's 90 degrees and sunny. He's wearing a dark suit and red tie. This was the first the public has heard from the man now associated with the most lethal bioweapons attack in U.S. history. Hatfill looks nervous but ready to tell his side of the story. It doesn't take him long to get emotional.
My girlfriend was locked inside an FBI car and hauled off to FBI headquarters and interrogated for hours. She was screamed at by FBI agents and told that the FBI had firm evidence that I had killed five innocent people. The FBI trumpets that I am not a suspect, and the woman I love is told by the FBI that I am a murderer.
Hatfill speaks for about 30 minutes, and before he's done, he takes the term person of interest and turns it against the FBI.
My lawyers can find no legal definition for a person of interest. I, however, have a working definition. A person of interest is someone who comes into being when the government is under intense political pressure to solve a crime, but can't do so, either because the crime is too difficult to solve or because the authorities are proceeding in what can mildly be called a wrong-headed manner. What is useful is that the FBI can be seen to be on the job, but they are in a rough place. If the FBI does not have me as a person of interest, then what does it have? What it has is a stalled investigation. Thank you.
So let me back you up. I want to tell you about why I've had reluctance to cooperate with the press about this case. Dr. Hatfill had no more involvement in the murders of the people who suffered these anthrax murders than either you or I. So you should not know his name.
Tom Connolly took over as Hatfill's lawyer after the press conference, when it became clear that Hatfill was going to need more firepower for this fight than Vic and his small civil rights law firm could provide. Hatfill chose well. Tom is a relentless, hard-charging criminal defense attorney who takes his cases personally.
So for the FBI to hint to the American public that Dr. Hatfill was the killer here, based on what I saw in the missteps and the amateur nature of the investigation, this was the FBI trying to send a message to the American public that, hey, we've got a guy on our radar, wink, wink, and if Dr. Hatfill had to be sacrificed for that notion, so be it.
After the raid, the FBI's cards were on the table. But since they couldn't detain Hatfill, they assigned agents to clock his every move.
They wanted him to know that he was being watched at all times. They wanted him, it was an exquisite form of torture, so that they could just sweat him and make him feel uncomfortable at all times, so that perhaps he would break.
This investigative tactic is called bumper locking, and it's legal, even if it sounds like a libertarian nightmare of government intrusion.
So one day he was being tailed by a team that was bumper locking him, meaning that they were literally a foot behind his bunker, driving for miles. And he beat them across on a green light that turned orange, and they went through the orange anyway and almost struck a mother walking a small child in a carriage. And this incensed Dr. Hatfill, so he got out and he started screaming at them that they are endangering people by doing this. And they didn't know what to do. They panicked. They drove away. And when they drove away, they drove over his foot. So what do? They decide to cite Dr. Hatfill for, I'm quoting, walking to create a hazard. They actually gave him a ticket.
All this public fumbling couldn't have come at a worse time. Powerful voices in the Bush administration were pushing for the FBI to be absorbed into the newly created Department of Homeland Security. The Bureau hadn't prevented 9/11. It hadn't caught Osama bin Laden. Now it couldn't even find the guy who had sent out the anthrax letters. The question had to be asked. Could the FBI keep the American people safe? The pressure was mounting on Mueller's head and trickled through the entire agency. It was time for new leadership on Amerithrax.
My boss walked into my office and said, hey, the director would like you to take over the anthrax investigation. Would you be willing to do it? And I said, of course, I'll be willing to do whatever he wants me to do. I mean, that's what I signed on to do. Whatever the needs of the Bureau are, I'm here to meet those.
Rick Lambert had been in charge of the FBI's San Diego field office. He'd only worked with Mueller a handful of times, but he'd left an impression on the director. The offer to lead Amerithrax came as a surprise to Rick, but he was nothing if not a company man.
I just got an apartment in Washington, and I left my wife behind in San Diego. You know, being on my own and alone in D.C., it allowed me to devote every waking moment to the investigation because I didn't have a requirement or a responsibility pulling at me.
By the time Rick took over in October 2002, Amerithrax had gone from the Bureau's highest priority to a public fiasco with not a lot of progress.
When I arrived at the Washington field office, what I found was that the thrust of the investigation seemed to be centered on following various hunches that people had about who may have done this. And I'm not Columbo, and I'm not a hunch guy.
Despite all the embarrassment and setbacks the FBI had faced, when Rick reviewed the evidence, he didn't see a compelling reason to stop looking into Hatfill.
The FBI tells ABC News it is very confident that it has found the person responsible.
That's right, Peter. Stephen Hatfill. And while there's no direct evidence, authorities say they are building what they describe as a growing case of circumstantial evidence. And their secret weapon has been a three-member team of bloodhounds.
Should we go right to the dogs?
Yeah.
Tinkerbell?
Yeah, Tinkerbell. One of the reasons they got excited about Dr. Hatfill is because they said that a dog from the L.A. Sheriff's County Department, Tinkerbell, identified Doc as the perpetrator.
Lucy, Knight, and Tinkerbell were the names of three bloodhounds the FBI hired to track the scent of the anthrax mailer. FBI agents had the dogs sniff sterilized envelopes from the anthrax mailings so they could identify a human with a matching scent. When they saw Hatfill, the dogs went nuts. Hatfill didn't know they were on his scent, so he bent down and petted Tinkerbell.
So, if you were an experienced prosecutor or an FBI agent, you might step back and ask yourself, well, can Tinkerbell do what they suggest he can do? I went on the internet for 15 minutes, and I found the leading researcher in the United States about scent discrimination within dogs. And I say to him, can this be done? And the answer is, he says to me, Tom, we've been doing research in this particular area of scent discrimination for years. It's impossible. It cannot be done.
Making matters worse, Tinkerbell's nose had led law enforcement astray before. The result? An innocent man had been arrested and imprisoned in a serial rape case in Long Beach, California.
And it turned out not to be him. It turned out that this guy smelled because he never showered and had really stinky feet, and Tinkerbell identified him.
Coming on the heels of Ashcroft's misstep, plus the bumper locking debacle, and Hatfill's defiant press conference, the bloodhounds would become another embarrassment to heap on the FBI's investigation. Especially after the FBI started thinking there might be evidence hidden in a state park near Hatfill's home. Lucy, Knight, and Tinkerbell were brought in to sniff the area.
And there were two ponds in particular where they indicated that they were finding scent from the envelopes or letters in the area. The first time we explored the two ponds, we had dive teams from a number of law enforcement agencies. We cut holes through the ice, had them go into the ponds. It was the middle of winter, very cold.
The FBI investigated 10 ponds. Then they settled on one to search more fully. When they realized that using divers and dredging wouldn't be enough, they decided to drain the entire pond. They spent $250,000 and pumped out 50,000 gallons of pond water until finally they found something.
So what we retrieved from the pond was what appeared to be an improvised glove box. It was one of these Sterilite plastic containers. It had a couple of holes cut in it that could have been used for gloves.
Glove boxes are those things you've seen on a million science shows. They're sealed, transparent containers with glove inserts. Scientists use them to work with hazardous materials.
And it was weighted down with a rock, so it was meant to be kept at the bottom of the pond. When we recovered the box, we had it tested for the presence of anthrax, and the testing that was done did find trace amounts of anthrax in the bottom of the container.
So, aha, a huge break in the case, right?
Now, the FBI subsequently reversed course on that and said, no, we think it was due to cross-contamination. We don't think there was any anthrax inside the box.
But still, here was this odd object sunk at the bottom of a pond just a few miles from Stephen Hatfield's apartment. Rick asked around to figure out what it was. He called the DEA to see if it could have been used to grow mushrooms. He called the Smithsonian Museum to see if they'd ever seen anything like it. He came back empty-handed. If the box was some kind of MacGyvered home biolab, the FBI figured that scientists at USAMRID, like Hank Heine, would be able to identify it.
And they showed it all to us and said, what is this? And, you know, we said, oh, that's a turtle trap. Oh, no. This is the glove box. Well, did you find any anthrax in it? No, we didn't find any traces of anthrax. No, because it's a turtle trap.
The FBI still hadn't found any physical evidence linking Hatfield to the anthrax mailings. But that wasn't the only problem with the case against him. When Hatfield worked at USAMRID, he didn't have access to the lab's anthrax. In fact, Hatfield didn't have any experience working with anthrax at all. He was a virologist. Anthrax isn't a virus, it's a bacteria. And the seemingly damning fact that Hatfield was on Cipro antibiotics when the letters were mailed, it turns out he had a deviated septum that was prone to infection. There were lots of dents in the FBI's case against Hatfield. Here's his lawyer, Tom Connolly, again.
So I'm sitting on the sideline watching this investigation and the leaks about the dogs and about the box found, and I'm thinking, if these investigators are relying on this logic, we literally are Keystone Cop territory. No one has ever argued that they shouldn't have taken a look at Doc or 1,000 other scientists in the country. It was when they took a look at him and then fell in love with him and the confirmation bias took hold is where it all went really, really wrong.
Hatfield was fired from his job at Louisiana State University. He was shunned professionally. Before long, he shut himself in his girlfriend's apartment, started drinking, binge eating, unraveling. Tom was concerned about Hatfield. Not just as his client. He considered Hatfield a friend.
I just snapped and said, look, doctor, they burnt your house down. After you burn somebody's house down and you've taken all their clothes and you've left them with nothing, at some point, like any animal, they're going to come out fighting. And that's where he and I both were. All right.
So Tom sued everybody. He sued the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, and Vanity Fair, which had published a piece by a Shakespeare scholar who claimed he could use textual analysis to connect Hatfield to the letters. And then Tom went after the big dogs, the Justice Department, Attorney General Ashcroft, the FBI, and the head of the FBI's Washington, D.C. field office.
Can you tell me the names of other persons of interest in the Amerithrax investigation?
That's Tom, deposing FBI Director Mueller for the grand jury in the case.
Yes.
Okay. Provide those names to you.
No.
Okay. You can tell me, because you know them.
Yes.
Okay, and you won't tell me why.
Because part of the investigation.
Okay. Could the disclosure of those names of individuals on the person of interest list, could it cause harm to the individuals?
Perhaps.
Could it unfairly stigmatize them?
Perhaps.
Tom's questioning repeatedly twists FBI and DOJ officials into knots like this. They simply can't justify the way Hatfield was treated compared to others who are investigated. Here's Attorney General Ashcroft.
I don't know.
That was the answer he gave 85 times in response to Tom's questioning. Hatfield's lawsuits eventually ended in various ways. Vanity Fair settled, but said in a statement that the magazine's owner, Condé Nast Publications, and the author never intended to imply that they had concluded that Hatfield perpetrated the anthrax attacks. The New York Times got its case dismissed. The big win came against the Justice Department, which exonerated Hatfield and agreed to pay him a settlement of $4.6 million. The judge on the case announced that he couldn't find a scintilla of evidence that would indicate Dr. Hatfield had anything to do with the anthrax attacks. Nicholas Kristof published one of the more bizarre mea culpas you'll ever read. More than 6 years after his last column about Hatfield, While he did offer a direct apology to Hatfill early in his column, he spent the rest of the piece musing about the media's responsibility to weigh personal privacy against the public's right to know. When we contacted Christoph for comment for this series, he wrote back that he didn't have time to do an interview, but said, "It's a good idea for a podcast." As for Barbara Hatch Rosenberg, she has never made a public statement using Stephen Hatfill's name. So we reached out to her to see how she feels almost two decades later.
Hi, Dr. Rosenberg. Could I just ask you one or two questions?
Well, you can try it. You can try it.
Okay, great. You know, now that the FBI exonerated Stephen Hatfill, have you changed your mind about him, or do you still think your initial theory is the right one?
I say, how could anybody be thinking of him now?
Am I understanding you correctly that you're saying you don't believe that Hatfill could have been the one now? Is that right?
No, I don't. I certainly don't. It's ridiculous. I mean, I can't even talk about it. I was the one time in the very beginning when I thought of him, but I never used his name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that he did it. And nobody thinks he did it. Look, I can't talk about this. I'm sorry. I can't. So please excuse me, but I'm going to hang up. Bye.
Next time on Cover Up, the Anthrax Threat, agents turn to a single biodefense lab in Fort Detrick, Maryland for help. But when the investigation gets hairy, it leads some of the Amerithrax team to wonder, what if the call was coming from inside the house?
I went to a doctor's appointment one afternoon, and when I came back, the phone rang. And there was an agent that said, "I hope your health is good."
Well,
we were told, including me, that I needed to prove I was innocent. Not that they needed to prove I was guilty, but I needed to prove I was innocent.
Unlock all episodes of Cover Up the Anthrax Threat ad-free right now by subscribing to the Binge podcast channel. Not only will you immediately unlock all episodes of the show, but you'll get binge access to an entire network of other great true crime and investigative podcasts, all ad-free. Plus, on the first of every month, subscribers get a binge drop of a brand new series. That's all episodes, all at once. Unlock your listening now by clicking subscribe at the top of the Cover Up show page on Apple Podcasts or visit getthebinge.com to get access wherever you get your podcasts. Cover Up the Anthrax Threat is hosted by me, Josh Dean. The series was created and produced by Ben Robbins. It was written by Rajiv Gola. Our senior producer is Emil Klein. Additional production by Abhikar Adan and Natalia Winkleman. Emily Martinez is our story editor and executive producer. Our theme song was created by Ira Wolf Tootin. Sound design by Ewan Lytremuen and Bart Warshaw, with support from Emil Klein. The series was fact-checked by Jordan Reed and Callie Hitchcock. Special thanks to David Shin and Sue Zizza at Radio Wave Studios. And also to our operations team, Doug Slaywin, Ashley Warren, and Destiny Dingle. Campside's executive producers are me, Josh Dean, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Adam Hoff, and Matt Scher. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps other listeners find the show. And maybe recommend it to a friend while you're at it. Thanks for listening. See you next time.